Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. How big a deal was GM's restructuring announcement this week, which included 14,000 layoffs and a new emphasis on electric and self-driving cars? Well, Dustin Walsh from Crane's Detroit Business writes that the industrial revolution was a tipping point. GM's announcement may be another. He also writes that assembly line jobs did not make the U.S. a rich country. Innovation did. Let's talk about the GM announcement now, how it shines a new light on how America works, how America drives, and how Donald Trump's promise to bring back all the manufacturing jobs is mostly just a sideshow. Dustin Walsh, senior reporter for Crane's Detroit, joins us now, along with Emmy Goldstein, the Pulitzer Prize-winning Washington Post reporter who spent years immersed in Janesville, Wisconsin, where the nation's oldest operating GM assembly plant shut down in the midst of the Great Recession. With her book as background, Amy has an article on the new GM story coming this weekend. Amy Goldstein, welcome back, and Dustin Walsh, welcome to WNYC.
Thank you.
Great to be with you again.
Dustin, you write in Crane's Detroit, the American sedan is dead. In what way do you mean that?
Well, they're not selling. If you can't sell the car, there's no point in making it. So what we've kind of seen here lately is that the U.S. manufacturers or domestic manufacturing is basically ceding that space to the Japanese manufacturers.
Why can Toyota and Nissan make money on sedans and General Motors can't?
Well, it's a lot of things. I mean, it's a larger economic issue of currency fit, you know, different changes in currency and things like that and where they've built them. But, you know, the United States companies have focused so heavily on crossovers and trucks that, you know, the cars just aren't what people want.
And yet GM CEO Mary Barra said on Monday, not that GM is going out of business, but that it will keep making trucks and SUVs and crossovers and also focus more on future technologies like autonomous or self-driving and electric vehicles. So why does that mean 14,000 fewer jobs?
Well, I mean, the basic math here is that there's only about 12 moving parts on an electric vehicle compared to hundreds on a traditional gas combustion engine powered vehicle. So if you really kind of suss out the math there, fewer moving parts equals fewer parts in general, fewer suppliers to provide those parts, thus fewer jobs.
Before we bring in Amy, GM says it's closing 5 plants as a result of this in Michigan, Ohio, Maryland, and Canada. And you write that it shouldn't come as a surprise. Why not, and why does the larger media world seem to be reacting with such shock?
Well, I mean, if you look at kind of the trend of what's happening in car manufacturing, we have to really look at capacity usage. So that means how many cars can they make at these plants? Right now, we're over capital. There's overcapacity in the United States of about 3.2 million cars. General Motors accounts for 1 million of those. So they're not going to keep operating plants under capacity at that level. So obviously they need to kind of shore up that, otherwise they're just wasting space, right? And so really that's kind of why it shouldn't come as a surprise, is this is something that is sort of, you know, needed to happen for the company.
Amy Goldstein, what is your book on Janestown, Wisconsin's experience over the last decade predict what might happen now to people and families in these 5 places losing their GM factories in Michigan, Ohio, and Maryland, and Canada?
Well, I wanted to understand what it means for a proud community to lose a big auto plant. What happens when thousands of good jobs go away? And what I learned in Janesville, which is a small city in southern Wisconsin, is that there are a couple of important kinds of effects. One is there are cascading waves of jobs that go away. It's not just the General Motors jobs that are going to leave these communities that have been newly targeted for plant closings, but there are local suppliers in each of these communities, and it's likely that some of those jobs will go away. And because all those two sets of people have lost work, there's going to be less spending power in town. So some little restaurants might close or other small businesses that just don't have as many customers anymore. So there's a real domino effect that happens in town in terms of jobs. The other thing that happens is more about a community's identity. I was struck in particular that the Ontario plant in Oshawa has been a place that's been making vehicles for 100 years. I mean, there was another company that was a car manufacturer there long before General Motors arrived in the 1950s. So this is what this town thinks of itself, and it's very hard for communities to imagine a future that's different than their past. I mean, it's hard psychically, and it's hard in terms of trying to figure out what a place can do to try to bring in new kinds of work. And when places do find new kinds of work, if they're lucky enough to do that, it's very unlikely that either the pay level or the benefits will be good as General Motors has provided its workers.
President Trump famously won Wisconsin. I'm going to play a clip from the campaign. And I'm curious, Amy, how much you think, based on your Janestown reporting, was it from promises like this?
We're going to stop the outflow of jobs from our country and open a new highway of jobs back into our country.
How much do you think he got elected in terms of the Wisconsin electoral votes on things like that? And how much do those Janestown residents and families like them see that promise being kept?
Well, I think there's a bit of a bipartisan tradition of making promises about manufacturing jobs persisting or at least not going away or increasing. Barack Obama, when he was a U.S. senator running for president the first time, made a big economic speech right inside the Janesville Assembly Plant. And he said in that plant, "The promise of Janesville is the promise of America." And he basically told all the workers and other people who were listening to him inside the factory that day that if they voted for him and followed his economic prescription, because this was early in the Great Recession when the economy was in pretty bad shape, he said, "If we do these things, this plant is going to be here for another 100 years." That was in February of 2008. And the plant turned out its last Chevy Tahoe 2 days before Christmas that December. So Trump has been doing this. Obama did this. It's a very popular thing for politicians to want to promise that local jobs are going to be safe, and they aren't always. In terms of voting in Wisconsin, as you just suggested, when Wisconsin voted for President Trump in the 2016 election, it was the first time since the 1980s that that state had voted Republican in a presidential contest. However, in Janesville itself, which is an old union town that tends to tilt Democratic, that community didn't vote for Trump. They voted narrowly for Hillary Clinton. So I think that what you can see in Janesville is that kind of the union identity of the community and the politics associated with that have outlasted the jobs themselves.
Listeners, we're talking with Amy Goldstein from The Washington Post and author of the book Janesville, and Dustin Walsh, senior reporter for Crane's Detroit Business. And we can take your phone calls on any of this: how America works, how America drives, how Donald Trump's promise to bring back all the manufacturing jobs may go down as just a sideshow. Who listening right now has a connection to a GM employee, past or present? Or who wants to call in and say why you reject American sedans or anything related? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, with General Motors announcing this week closing 5 plants, eliminating 14,000 jobs. Dustin, the president tweeted this morning, "General Motors is very counter to what other auto and other companies are doing. Big Steel is opening and renovating plants all over the country. Auto companies are pouring into the U.S., including BMW, which just announced a major new plant." How much of that is true, especially with respect to the auto industry?
Almost none of it. I mean, obviously there has been some investments, but those investments were actually occurring, just coming out of the recession. So a lot of that investment is things that have been announced a long time ago that is finally starting to happen. The steel industry, yes, there has been some propping up thanks to the tariffs. I think the latest one is Steel Dynamics is opening a plant in Southwest United States, which amounts to about 600 jobs. And the BMW announcement was simply an idea floated in an interview with the reporters by the CEO of BMW. Said that they're looking at a potential plant, and the United States may get a transmission plant. It's certainly not a promise, certainly not something that is going to happen right now. Simply saying that because they do export quite a bit out of that plant in Spartanburg, South Carolina, moving a transmission plant there may make sense, at least in that region. But that is anything but certain at this point.
Amy, I don't know if this is on your beat in any way, but when the president says General Motors is very counter to what other auto companies are doing and auto companies are pouring into the U.S., what I guess he's trying to do is portray the General Motors move as not reflective of a failure of policy on his part in any way, but General Motors kind of being an outlier or being economically stupid internally, because look what's happening with the larger auto industry in America. Dustin says almost none of it is true. Do you have a perspective on that?
Well, I think that I don't cover the auto industry as a beat for the Post, but I think it's pretty obvious that the president was trying to insulate himself a little bit politically from some of the policies he favors about trade. There's debate about how much that may or may not play a role in General Motors' decision now and the costs of producing cars in the United States with these shifting trade policies. So I think that may have been what the president was alluding to. I think one thing a little bit more broadly that's clear is that when auto plants are debating whether to locate in a community, this is any car manufacturer, not just General Motors, these days there tends to be quite a bidding war because communities want those jobs. So there's quite a tradition that's built up of states and localities providing big offers of economic incentives to try to get jobs into their communities or to try to bring a new product in, as will be the case now in these plants, particularly the assembly plants, the three of the assembly plants that are targeted for closing. They want to try to see whether they can persuade GM to give them something else to manufacture. And those kinds of gifts of new products to make don't come inexpensively these days.
Let's take a call from Roy in Fairfield. Roy, you're on WNYC. Hi there.
Good morning, Brian. My question quickly, we had a bailout in 2018. We bailed out GM, among others, and now at the local and federal level, it seems like we're getting punished. We're closing factories where we propped them up, and in the news there was eminent domain in one of those communities where they basically took away all this residential units and then put in a factory that's now closed.
Roy, thank you for that. And that's one of the points, Dustin, that Trump has been making. We bailed you out, General Motors. We, never mind that we means the Democratic Congress and President Obama, which the Republicans opposed, but we, the United States, bailed out General Motors, and this is how you thank us? You destroy all these jobs? So what's how are you reporting on that?
Right. So, I mean, I think, you know, this comes into the broader aspect of the economy, global, if not national, is yes, the General Motors got a bailout in a sense. But the question is, what would have happened if that didn't happen? Would have General Motors ceased to exist? Would the entire supply chain collapse, causing hundreds of thousands of job losses? And now that they're on the mend and they're doing relatively well, the question is, how do they then proceed? Is their job simply to acquiesce to American demand for having factory jobs or to be a strong company in the future? I'm not saying one way is right or wrong or the other, but that is how the company is proceeding, is that we need to be a strong company and position ourselves for the future. This is the future of automotive in their minds. So really that means, you know, they're protecting the company, thus theoretically protecting more jobs by going the route they're going, which unfortunately does cost jobs to get from A to B.
Corin, a former GM employee in Warren, New Jersey. Corin, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hey, Brian. Thanks for taking the call. So I used to be a former employee up in Warren, Michigan, and now I live in Warren, New Jersey. And I used to work in product development for about 3-4 years before I decided to go a different route. And I left GM for many reasons that I still see now after several years, which is it's not everybody used to complain, and you know I used to complain as an employee about their cars and the cars are not selling, etc. The problem were never the cars; the problem was management and how, and also healthcare costs. At one point in time, we were paying $1 billion just on one purple pill for employees. So my issue is, it's the same management. Many of them are in the management are still the same. And just because they're taking a new tack, saying that they're going to place their bets on electric cars, I don't see the culture of the firm or anything else changing. So I don't know how they can expect to be competitive against many of the other car manufacturers who are making similar bets.
Interesting. And Corin, I'm going to leave it there because we have a terrible phone connection and probably a lot of the listeners couldn't even hear a lot of what you said. But to summarize one point of it, Dustin, he says GM's corporate culture is so dysfunctional and, you know, including the economics of their corporate culture, that he doesn't have confidence that even focusing on the technologies of the future, like autonomous cars and electric cars, that they're going to do well against the competition. Do you have an opinion about that?
I mean, sort of. I mean, so that's a residual effect, right? I mean, the corporate culture in particularly Southeast Michigan and Metro Detroit around the automotive industry, the big three at the time, was very negative at the recession, right? It was a slow moving industry. It didn't change its ways to the fundamentals of what was going on in the economy and people's choices and you know, the like. It's hard to make that argument again, saying, I mean, clearly General Motors is making a bet on the future. So it actually is trying to change. Whether that's going to be a right bet or the bet pays off, we don't know. But I think it's hard to put that on a corporate culture.
Amy, before you go, has Janesville started to grow something new in the post-industrial era to compensate for, you know, the loss of General Motors? Of course, we're seeing this question being asked in so many places in America. Pittsburgh has successfully started to grow a tech economy after losing so much of its steel economy, as one example. How about Janesville, which you wrote a whole book on, and is it a model for how other communities can move forward?
Well, one of the things I learned, I think, from the years that I spent getting to know people in Janesville is that it can take a very, very long time for it to start to become clear whether a community is going to recover or fall further apart. It turns out that Janesville is a very resilient, resourceful place with a sense of its own efficacy. And even before the plant actually closed, between the several months between the closing announcement and the final Tahoe coming off the assembly line, the community formed its own economic development coalition to try to prevent small businesses from leaving and to try to attract new jobs to town. That effort is still going on. It's very, very hard work. The big news in Janesville is that after many years in which the Janesville Assembly Plant was in a limbo status, it was in a status called standby. It was the only plant in all of General Motors in that status, which meant that it was completely quiet. Nothing was happening inside, but it was technically eligible to be reopened if the market circumstances ever warranted it. Finally, after years of this limbo, in 2015, General Motors formally closed the plant. And late last year, this huge piece of property, plant was 4.8 million square feet, just an enormous plant. It was sold to a company out of St. Louis that specializes in trying to redevelop distressed industrial property. And I was just in Janesville last month for the first time in several months, and I actually got a tour of the demolition that's underway. And it's something to see. All these enormous piles of different kinds of metal where the plant used to stand that are now going to be sold off for scrap. So that demolition is going to go on for another few months until the property is, you know, kind of cleared to the ground. And only at that point will the new owners try to market it to businesses and other concerns that want to use the parcels of the property for something. So that something is completely uncertain, even now, almost 10 years to the day after the plant closed. So that's kind of what I mean when I say that it can take a long time for mm-hmm. community's future to start to become evident.
Amy, I know you have to go. Amy Goldstein, Washington Post health policy reporter, usually, and author of Janesville, An American Story, now out in paperback. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Dustin Walsh, who covers the auto industry, among other things, for Crane's Detroit Business. I want to ask you one more thing before you go. I want to play you a clip, actually, of Michael Moore on Chris Hayes' show on MSNBC on Tuesday.
But he gets into office, and what does he do? He gives them a big tax cut. He eliminates federal regulations for fuel efficiency, for air pollution. He does all the things that they want him to do as their boy.
Yep.
And then this is what they go do. And then he's all today like,
right.
You know, it's like, you're such a fool, Trump.
Right.
And you've been played again by these people who've never liked you.
So did General Motors play Donald Trump?
I don't know if I have an answer to that question. I mean, certainly, you know, this is General Motors is making a decision to the future. They view the future as electrification. They got the tax cut they wanted. Sure. That I'm sure they were rallying for. They got the CAFE standards slowed so they can still rely on the incredibly heavily profitable truck market. I think that's something people forget. I mean, we talk about the big, you know, some of these big, like, you know, large heavy duty trucks. I mean, the margin on some of these $80,000-$90,000 trucks is $50,000. They make an incredible amount of money on these trucks. So they don't want the CAFE regulations, the fuel economy regulations to stiffen because they make so much money on those. But the reality is that if the future is truly autonomous, where these cars are driving themselves and maybe ownership is not necessarily a part of that, that has to be an electrical future. So they're getting their way on both sides of the coin here, allowing them to make a very expensive bet. And that's what they're doing.
Dustin Walsh from Crane's Detroit, thank you so much for coming on with us.
Thank you.